the Past Lives Podcast, episode 185, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. My mission here at the Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And this is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 15 minutes, and to get access to the extra 15 minutes and the other extended versions of these episodes, you can join the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon campaign has been changed recently so that the previous bonus episodes have been removed and the extended episodes remain. This means that including this episode, there are now 29 extended episodes available to the $5 patrons. And you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bown. This week I'm talking to Shepard Hudwin about his book, Compassion for Evil, A Metaphysical View. Shepard is a channel who specializes in the Michael teachings about how we set up our lifetimes. He's been channeling Michael since 1986. He also does intuitive readings, mediumship, past life regression, healing, counseling, and channel coaching. He's conducted workshops on the Michael teachings throughout the United States. He is the author of several books on the Michael teachings and spirituality. Hi, Shepard. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Simon.
I invited you back because I saw the book you'd written called Compassion for Evil, A Metaphysical View, which is, you know, something that people never really talk about. You were on episode 41, and it was such a great episode, and you did my Michael chart. You're a channel. So can you tell us about Michael and your channeling?
Yes, Michael is the name of what we call a reunited causal plane entity. According to the Michael teachings, there are seven planes of creation. Obviously, we're here on the physical plane. The physical plane is about matter and solid energy. The second plane is the astral, which is emotional. The third is the causal, which is intellectual. We all finish the physical plane and move through the higher planes until we're reunited back into the Tao, where we originate. The Michael entity is simply an arbitrary name given to a group of 1,050 souls who all had lifetimes here on the physical plane, finished that, finished the second plane, the astral, and worked together as a team to teach from the causal plane. And their project is something that we've come to call the Michael Teachings, which is this fascinating body of knowledge that explains how we, as souls, set up our series of lifetimes here on Earth as human beings. It explains so much about why we are the way we are and what we're doing here.
And are there other people that channel Michael?
Yes, there's quite a number. So the Michael teachings are unique in that, first of all, they're channeled by a number of people, and second, because they brought through a discrete system with a lot of terminology that is unique to the Michael teachings. So it's rather like if someone channeled something called astrology, and then a bunch of other people started channeling the same entity, and we get this vast system called astrology. So Michael's teachings are not astrology, but as an analogy, it's a system that explains the personality, the self, and what we're doing here.
And do you see consistency across everybody that has these communication?
There's a great deal of consistency among what comes through the various Michael channels, and there are also occasionally discrepancies. And sometimes the discrepancies are explained by a higher piece of information that unites the two pieces. And sometimes maybe you see this in your own life where you thought you were in contradiction with someone else, and then you learned something else and you realize, you know, we're actually on the same page here or pretty close to it. And then there are some actual disagreements among the channels, because there is nothing in this universe that's perfect. We're all growing, we're all learning, we're all changing. And the act of channeling itself is imperfect because it has to come through imperfect channels.
And is it something for you? Is it automatic writing, or is it that you go into a trance and Michael takes over?
I channel consciously, meaning that I step to the side, but I'm still fully conscious during the process. There are other Michael channels who go into deeper trance. There are a lot of different ways that people channel. I was so fascinated by this topic that I wrote the book Journey of Your Soul, A Channel Explores the Michael Teachings, where the first 100 pages are about channeling itself, material that I developed by interviewing other channels and channeling about channeling, because I wanted to understand it better. So it happens differently. The agreements between the channeled entities and the channels are not the same in all cases, and the techniques used are not the same in all cases. There are a lot of different ways to accomplish that.
So I suppose some of the channels, it's down to that person's interpretation of the information that's coming through. Because I assume that everybody that does it, not everyone gets perfect sentences that they can just write out and there's no interpretation.
Right. Well, in any channeling, the entity that's being channeled relies on the instrument, which is the channel. And the instrument includes the facility for language and the ability to write and speak and so forth. And so the channeled entity is always limited to some extent by the limitations of the channel. Again, it's not perfect. There's just nothing in this universe that is perfect. So if a channel has strong biases, that may limit what can come through that channel. Even if the person is channeling a deep trance, so you can lessen the influence of bias, but if there are strong walls in the subconscious of the instrument being used, then that can limit or distort what comes through. In all walks of life, the more we can release our biases and be clear, the better results we're going to get, including with channeling.
So you say in the introduction that this book was a tough nut to crack. What did you mean by that?
Well, we're talking about evil here. And by definition, evil has a very dense vibration. And when you bring your consciousness into it and try to get clarity, it's first like swimming through mud. It vibrates slowly. You might think of a spectrum from the most positive, which is light and airy and clear, to the most negative, which is dense and dark and thick and doesn't feel very good. And so the spectrum from good to evil follows that, where you start on the higher vibration and we can talk about love and light and it feels wonderful, and we start talking about evil, and we're tuning into that in an effort to get clarity around it, and we're dealing with some pretty murky stuff. So I first channeled about evil from Michael in the late 90s, and I thought this was a really important subject, and I knew then that I wanted to write something about it, and it went through various drafts over about 20 years before I felt like I had cracked that nut and therefore published Compassion for Evil.
When you say it's Compassion for Evil, a metaphysical view, what do you mean by a metaphysical view? Is it like the viewpoint from at the soul level outside of a human life, looking down on what's happening?
Exactly.
I suppose there's that thing that you could look on something that happens on Earth to somebody And what's happened is something evil's happened to them. Somebody really nasty has done something. But by experiencing that evil thing, that's a great thing for the soul to grow.
Yes. Yes. So my understanding is that there are countless planets throughout our universe where there are beings like us. In the Michael teachings, we call them sentient. They're defining that a little differently than the way people normally do. By sentient, they mean that these are creatures of reason, that these are complex souls capable of purely intellectual function, who are inhabiting some kind of life form on the physical plane, which may or may not look like humans. And we're coming here to have experiences. We're here to grow. We're here to expand the Tao, which is the source of all things, to expand the knowledge of unconditional love. And you could view the physical plane of all these planets as sort of the first step or a primary school for the soul. On the physical plane, we often grow through polarity. Polarity means that we compare opposites and we learn to find the best of both of them. We have a great deal of polarity on the physical plane of Earth, such as we have male and female, we have light and dark, we have up and down, and we have good and evil. I would define evil as doing tangible harm to another being, limiting their choices, and good as benefiting others, expanding their choices, giving them more opportunities to grow. On Earth, we have what is often thought of as this great battle between good and evil. But the funny thing is that those who, objectively speaking, are doing a lot of evil things, in other words, they're doing a great deal of harm, still often think of themselves as being good. They've rationalized it. They think, well, I'm fighting this war for the glory of God, or I'm doing this terrible thing to you for your own good, or I don't want to do this, but I have to do this, and harm is being done. So most people, when they think about the war between good and evil, think of themselves as the good ones. And that is part of what makes it really murky, because very few people who, objectively speaking, are doing a great deal of harm to others own it. They rationalize it. And this comes down to the human relationship with fear. To understand evil, we have to understand fear. There's nothing wrong with fear. Fear is hardwired into our human bodies to make us aware of things that might endanger us. So it's deeply tied into the human survival instinct on an animal level. Fear will kick in, for example, if you encounter a ferocious wild animal who might maul you. And so your body starts pumping adrenaline, and it makes you hyper alert. And hopefully it enables you to pay attention so that you will then do something to preserve your survival. It might make you run away, or it may make you shoot the bear, whatever, but it certainly makes you alert. So it provides a necessary function to the human animal. In nature, when animals experience, for example, an encounter with a predator, after the threat has passed, they generally release it from their physical body. They don't store it. They'll go shake it out. You might see an animal after a dangerous encounter shaking their body or rolling around in the mud or whatever. And they get themselves back to their resting place, and then they go on with their day. What we call trauma describes a situation in which we did not shake that out. We start storing it in the body. And then we generalize from that threat in our dull effort to learn from that experience that says, well, for example, in the case of meeting a wild animal, this happened in a dark forest. The subconscious that isn't really thinking very logically will then generalize, this happened in a forest, therefore all forests are dangerous, and I must stay away from them. What happens with the human animal is that we also have these sophisticated minds that can generalize. And also we then start associating our fears about survival not only to genuine physical threats, but to what we emotionally perceive as threats, which may not be valid. In the Michael teachings, we define seven chief obstacles or chief fears or chief features. And these are things that the soul has developed maybe over many lifetimes as a self-protective mechanism. For example, there's one that's called arrogance, and arrogance is defined as a fear of vulnerability and a fear of being judged. So what happens with that is that the person might have many experiences in which they were brutally criticized. And maybe in one lifetime that literally led to the person's death. For example, let's say you had a physical deformity and the people in your village thought that that this meant that there was some evil spirit that was making you that way, and therefore they killed you. So in your subconscious, you associate any criticism with death, and therefore you are always mobilized to defend against being criticized to an extreme degree. And this could make you self-conscious, where you're watching everything you do so that people don't criticize you. It can make you quick to attack others first, criticize them before they have a chance to criticize you. It can make you withdraw and retreat. And this has all happened because you generalize too much from one or two experiences, and now you are using it in all experiences as part of your survival instinct. And it's not healthy. So one of the great tools of the Michael teachings is learning to notice when your chief obstacle is activated and to bring truth to it. The chief obstacle, like all these survival instinct impulses, are designed to work on automatic pilot. And as such, they're a blunt instrument. They may help us in some very limited circumstances, but if we can bring conscious awareness into them, we can control them and say, okay, let's calm down here. This is not applicable. I'm not going to die if I'm criticized. But for example, let's say you're a singer and an actor and you love to act and perform and you have a glorious voice and people love you, your work, but you have this fear of being judged and of being vulnerable. And so you get up on stage and you have this horrendous stage fright and you freeze. And therefore you cannot share your gift. Your fear of being judged immobilizes you, and you've actually created more of the thing that you were afraid of happening. In other words, you don't do the performance that you are capable of giving, and therefore people do judge you. And so that may make a loop where you think to yourself, well, that just goes to show that being judged is the worst possible thing that can happen, and you stop performing. So what you feared the most, you created because you stayed in this unconscious loop of fearing being judged. Now, this is just one example of the seven obstacles and how they act in our subconscious. So we shut down, and the fear leads to having more fear. The flip side of fear is anger. Fear simply suggests that we perceive a threat, and we're going to strategize to protect ourselves. One way that we do this is withdrawing from things such as the performer who stopped performing, used fear as an excuse to not deliver their gifts into the world. The flip side of fear is anger. So, for example, if you mess up rather than withdrawing, you go on the attack. Fear and anger are not really emotions. They are part of that survival instinct. The fear withdraws from the perceived threat, and the anger attacks the thing that seems like a threat, but it's really the same thing. They can both exist in the same person, where they either act out of anger and or fear in any given situation. But they are negative. They lead to negative emotions, such as bitterness, resentment, hate, etc. They lead to these when they're not made conscious and handled by our conscious mind.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, some of you know I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyze what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. There's something you say in the book is, on Earth, free will makes for the possibility of evil. Because we come into our lives when perhaps we have a life plan, but that plan doesn't always work, does it? Because we have free will. And it's also the free will that makes the possibility for evil.
Right. You know, people are always saying things like, why does God permit this to happen? And this can disillusion people. It can turn them into atheists, or it can make them severely doubt the existence of God or a higher power or whatever. Why does God permit this to happen? But if you look around at the world we live in, you simply do not see some supernatural force stopping people from doing bad things. It just never happens. And so that should be a clue that people are widely misunderstanding what we're doing down here on the physical plane, how it's all set up. We do have free will. And so that includes the right to do evil things, to violate other people, to form karmic bonds with other people. By that I mean that if you violate another person, you have taken something from them that does not belong to you. And what you've taken then has a natural urge to return to that person. For example, if I form a karmic ribbon with you by murdering you in cold blood because I wanted to, or because I was furious at you for, you know, sleeping with my wife or something like that, I have taken something from you that did not belong to me, which is your life, your energy. And that energy intrinsically wants to go back to the person it belongs to, which is you. So now I've formed a karmic ribbon with you. And the next time I run into you on the physical plane, I may have set it up to repay that debt that I now owe to you. And that may be done in one of two ways. I might save your life, maybe in between lives, I say, "Oh, Simon, I'm really sorry that I murdered you. I was in a bad place right then. And I want to make it up to you in our next lifetime. I want to save your life in a really dramatic way." And you say, "Oh, that sounds like a good learning experience for both of us. So let's set it up so that in the next lifetime, you're a doctor and I come in with this really difficult disease and you cure me and you save my life." So that would be a positive way of me repaying that karmic debt I owe to you. The more obvious way of doing it is we run into each other in the next lifetime and we feel this energy imbalance between us. And since I had murdered you, you murder me, and then the karmic debt is also dispatched in that way. So this is one of the ways that we learn and grow on the physical plane. And a lot of people find this karmic interplay really exciting. So they keep it going. It seems like a really interesting drama, just in the same way that so many people enjoy watching this kind of drama in TV shows and movies. It's fascinating to them. But many of your listeners are probably interested in getting off the karmic wheel. Well, the karmic wheel is a Hindu term that means that I murder you, you murder me. And then because I haven't really gotten the lesson that, oh, you did that because of what I did to you, I take offense that you murdered me in the second instance, and I murder you again. And then you get really, really mad and you murder me again. Or you're so mad you go out and murder a bunch of other people. And this just keeps going round and round and round in a circle like a hamster on a hamster wheel. And it just never ends. And a lot of people are stuck in that karmic wheel. If you have decided to embark on a conscious spiritual path, you say, in effect, "I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get off the karmic wheel, and I want to instead have my lessons through joyous experiences, through loving ones, where I help you and you help me," because you can grow just as much through joy as you can through pain, although all of us will at times grow through pain, through making mistakes, through forming karma, whatever. But if you're on a conscious spiritual path, it's a choice to grow in more joyful and loving ways, to learn consciously what love is. And so that means that if we're finishing up karmas with other people, instead of retaliating, we say, "I'm going to accept what happens to me with grace. I'm going to have radical acceptance for everything that happens to me. I'm going to meet hate with love in all circumstances." And so you start doing that and the vibration goes up. So if you look at evil as zero and ultimate love as 100, there's that scale. And the closer you get to zero, the uglier the energy is, the more dense, dark, and so forth. And all these really negative, bitter, ugly emotions feel really awful. They're really dense. And you start moving up more towards 100, and you start having energies and feelings that are lovely and that make you happy. You cannot be evil and be happy. It's impossible, because evil pulls your vibration down. The evil person may get temporary gratification of their urges. You know, they wanted something and they got it and they feel triumphant, but they're not happy because the energies are too dense. In fact, when you do something awful on the physical plane, when you die, you sort of come to your senses and you feel the heaviness of it. And that's why people want to repay karmas, because it feels so awful. It's like, I really need to get this heavy weight off of my shoulders. So there is a built-in incentive to repay karma. But some people get really stuck in this karmic wheel. They don't ever take responsibility. They don't ever say, "This bad thing happened to me because of my own actions." They always say, "This is the other person's fault." So if you want to accelerate on the spiritual path, if you want to grow into as high and beautiful a place as possible, the first step for all of us is the willingness to look deeply and honestly in the mirror and to take responsibility for our own mistakes, our own karmic formations. So in fact, you would want to look at every unpleasant interchange with another person. And the first thought would be, what can I learn from this? How could I have handled this better? What was my part in this? And people who lean more towards the evil end of the spectrum rarely do this. They rarely take any responsibility. They never apologize. They're never wrong about anything. And that isn't just because they're getting stuck in evil. It's because they don't know any better, because their defense mechanisms are extremely heavily protected. There are a lot of walls. So the idea here is with the chief obstacles is the misunderstanding that these things have protected me from harm and they're continuing to protect me. The chief obstacle says to us, in effect, I'm keeping you from dying. And that's pretty serious. It's a lie, but the subconscious really believes it. And so all of the defense mechanisms that we build up over many lifetimes around these dysfunctional patterns can make it very hard to look in the mirror. When somebody is courageous and says, I'm terrified, but I am going to look at this wound. I am going to look at this past life where something really horrible happened to me, even though part of me is desperately afraid of looking at this pain that I've protected for so long. When there's courage and we look at it for maybe the first time, it can be a shattering, devastating experience. I'm sure you've found that in taking people into their past lives, that there are things they don't want to look at, that they're terrified of, but you gently guide them there. And if they have the courage to do it, it can break down this defense and it can be so incredibly liberating. But a lot of people are not willing or not yet willing to do that. And so it could be that then their vibration just keeps getting heavier and heavier and heavier because they repeat these karmic patterns and they get further and further meshed into these defense mechanisms. So we look at these people and we just see that, well, they're very unpleasant, they're very negative, and I don't want to be around that. And we start to think of them as these two-dimensional archetypes of evil, sort of like the mustache twirling villain in the cartoons that, I'm going to do this dastardly thing because I just like doing dastardly things to people. There's no real thought given to, well, how did this soul get into this predicament? And if you look beneath the surface, there's a great deal of pain. Michael Moore tells this anecdote of a number of years ago being on a talk show that Donald Trump was also being interviewed on. And they met in the green room, which is, you know, where you get ready for your appearance, you get your makeup and change your clothes or whatever. And he was so struck by how deeply insecure Donald Trump was in person. You know, he would put on this bravado in public, like, you know, I'm the big cheese and, you know, so pompous and boastful about all of his accomplishments. But then seeing the real person, he saw this very vulnerable, frightened, really little boy. And so we start to look into Donald Trump's life. A woman posted on Facebook saying, I knew Donald Trump's mother, and she was the coldest human being I ever met in my life. And the father was also, known to be a crook, like just a horrible person. So here is someone who did not get a shred of love from his earliest age. So had he been a more advanced soul, he might have been able to overcome that bad start in life. And some souls overcome really horrible, abusive childhoods to become loving and great human beings. But some, especially younger souls, don't have the tools to do that. And he did not. He didn't have the tools to overcome it. He never really got past being a wounded two-year-old. And so this is the sort of behavior that comes from that. And so this is why I advocate that rather than taking an adversarial view towards people who do a lot of evil things, that we have compassion for them and realize that they're very wounded people. This does not in any way excuse their behavior. I am not at all saying, well, they were really hurt, so, you know, whatever they do is okay. But one of the divine paradoxes here is that we can be very loving, elevated beings who have unconditional love for all beings, including those who do a lot of evil things in the world, and at the same time, strategize about how can we minimize the negative effects of their actions, which might mean arresting someone who has broken the law, putting them in jail. It might even mean in rare instances that if you have an aggressive tyrant who's invading other countries, that you go to war to stop them. This should be used very sparingly. We look at World War II, it became necessary to stop Hitler's aggression. And yet if we look to World War I, we can see that if the winners had handled that better and been loving and merciful towards Germany, Hitler would not have probably come into power. So most wars have shown themselves to have been unnecessary and a blunt instrument for handling something that could have been much better handled. But in any case, when people act in a violating manner, we could look at it dispassionately, like we're playing a chess game. And we just look down at the chessboard and say, okay, this person made this move. What can I or we do about this that will minimize the harm that this person is doing? And think creatively, thoughtfully about this, and then take an action. But doing it without unnecessary harm or collateral damage. What's going to be the most effective thing here? You think about all of these policemen who are murdering people who they perceive as committing a crime when that wasn't necessary at all, that the person could maybe have been stopped with a taser without doing any harm to their body. But they're using this tool that did much more harm than the perceived harm that they were trying to stop. And they're doing that because they have a storehouse of fear and anger that they don't know what to do with. Again, fear and anger are really the same things. They're just two sides of one coin. Some people act with this perception of being threatened with fear, or they withdraw. Some people perceive more with anger, they get more aggressive, and human beings are a rather aggressive species on an animal level, so there's a lot of that. But when people store the old anger, they didn't shake it off, they're always looking for ways to get it out of their system, so they overreact to threats, such as in the case of these police officers or these soldiers who commit these atrocities. If people were trained in how to release their old anger and fear in healthy, therapeutic ways, we would have a vastly different world than we have. And certainly all people who are in positions of public trust and are entrusted with weapons, such as police officers and soldiers, should be trained in how to release their old anger so that they can approach threats in a calm way and evaluate them. If we react to people who are doing violating things with our own unresolved fear and anger, we are choosing to stay on the karmic wheel and we are down on their level. So we're still fighting this imaginary war of good versus evil thinking we're the good ones, and our opponents probably thinking that they're the good ones. But if we are choosing love, we rise above that playing ground of the war of good versus evil, and we simply are in love. And we say, okay, here's another thing to handle. How do we handle this with wisdom?
There is one thing that you sort of touched on with young souls. I'm kind of suggesting that they don't have experience of life to change what's happening to them, and they go into a much darker and darker place. It's something you said in the book, nearly all of those whose hearts are profoundly hardened are young souls. And do they get into a point where they just never get out of that?
Yes. I'm careful in the book to differentiate between evil acts and evil people. Most people have done some evil things, and by evil, I'm simply defining that as something violating something that does harm, tangible harm. And by tangible harm, I mean objective harm, not an offense to somebody's sensibilities, you know, like calling someone a name. It's not like that, but you've really limited that person's life in a meaningful way that's making it harder for them to follow their life plan. So we've probably all done some harmful things in our various lifetimes that could be called evil. But there are very few people that I would classify as being evil people. That classification in my mind would come when someone is hardened so much that they cannot be reached with love, that their heart is completely closed down. And when that happens, and when efforts have been made to open people up so that they can start growing again, even in a slow way, sometimes a choice is made to just disassemble that soul. And that's called astral suicide. So the guides and the soul, who's in, at that point, enormous suffering, even though they may act like a total villain who doesn't care about anyone's feeling, they might act on the surface like a sociopath. But on the higher levels, and the soul level, there's enormous suffering. And it's like, okay, I've painted myself into a corner and I can't get out of it. I've tried everything I know how to do. And so at that point, and this is very rare, the guides who work with that soul may agree, okay, well, you tried, didn't work out, better luck next planet. And they disassemble that soul. So that would be the end result of someone who is irredeemably evil, who's shut down. Generally speaking, in our first lifetimes on the physical plane, what the Michael teachings refers to as a survival-focused or infant soul, we start out in circumstances that are pretty easy. Often our first lifetimes were in these idyllic, simple environments, such as on a beautiful tropical island where the living is easy and the older souls around us help us get used to the planet, and we're learning how to eat and swim and have sex. And there can be some really beautiful early lifetimes. And this is what the Garden of Eden story in the Bible is depicting. Now, as souls age, they get a little bored with this, and often that's when karmic formation begins. It's a little bit like the toddlers on the playground who may have been just the sweetest babies before they were mobile. And then they start fighting with other children over their toys. This is sort of like souls starting karmic formation. It's like, no, this is my land. No, it's my land. They start fighting. They kill each other. And this can actually be rather entertaining and interesting and allow the soul to have a lot of lessons. But hopefully at this point, the soul has experienced enough love and goodness that they can get back there. They can say, oh, yeah, I murdered that person and I had no idea of the implications, but in the next lifetime, that person murdered me and that didn't feel so good. And I can see my family weeping and wailing because they killed me. And I see that now that when I killed you, I caused a lot of unhappiness. So there begins to be the thought of maybe I don't want to keep doing this. And maybe the soul learns something. But if the soul hasn't gotten off to a great start, if there was maybe too much trauma too early for the soul to really process and handle, and the soul starts hardening, it can cause trouble. Now, let's say the soul does start hardening, but is redeemed. You know, like the song Amazing Grace, you know, I saw the error of my ways and I'm deeply humbled by this. Then that can be very valuable. The soul might go, oh yeah, I went into a really dark place there. And I also went into a really loving place and I see the difference. And I'm now seeing more clearly than ever before what love is. I don't take it for granted anymore because I can compare and contrast it to something very lacking in that love vibration. So it can be beneficial to explore the world of evil, both as a victim and as a perpetrator of it. But some people get stuck there. There's also the issue that this planet itself has been going through what the Hindus call a Kali Yuga, which is a vast age where the cosmic weather, you might say, is darker than usual. So there has been more darkness in our experience over the last several thousand years, and they believe that we're coming out of that. So there really is an opportunity now. The weather is better. There's more cosmic sunshine. It's going to make it possible for more people to wake up to greater love and to develop the ability to grow more joyfully.
There was something else you said in the book. There can be increased negativity temporarily by foreign entities, such as parasitic lower astral plane energies. So is this kind of like where a soul or a person would not be evil, but something external to them influences them?
Yes, this is very interesting to me also. We all have an aura or energy field. It goes around our body, maybe a few feet. And ideally, we run that energy in a clean way, and it only has our own soul's energy in it. And that's going to feel best to all of us. However, our energy field is porous. And other people's energies can get into it, as well as energetic flotsam and jetsam that just happens to be floating around in the atmosphere. And so I jokingly refer to keeping our aura clean as practicing good oral hygiene, spelled A-U-R-A-L. Yeah. In other words, people who are on a spiritual path, who want to keep their aura clean, have many techniques at their disposal in order to keep it clean. And one of the things that you do is you scan the walls of your aura for any openings that are allowing foreign energies and entities to get in, and you just keep cleaning that up. You keep healing it. You keep sending back to other people energies that belong to them so that you're not carrying them. So often we take on other people's negative energies because we want to help them. But it's not really the most effective way of helping them. Because you might say that their energy has their energetic imprint on it, and you don't have the key to that lock or the combination to that lock. You can't really change how they're running their energy. You can show them a better way. So you can help heal other people, but not by taking on chunks of their negative energy and trying to fix it. That doesn't work very well. And yet a lot of us are chronically trying to do that. So one of the best healing things we can do for ourselves is to go into meditation, take a snapshot of our energy field, ask to see what is in there that doesn't belong to us, and return it to its owner. And we can scan the walls, as I say, of our energy field and bring healing to that. And then we can also destroy thought forms that have drifted in from the mass consciousness or debris energies, like you walk into a room where people have been fighting and maybe some of that energy gets lodged in your field, you can clear it out. This is something that is a positive thing for all of us to do on a daily basis. Now, let's say you go into the hospital and they operate on you. When they cut into your physical body, they are also of necessity cutting into your etheric body, which is part of your aura. And that may not heal up properly after the surgery. And so then foreign things can get in. Hospitals are really pretty awful places energetically because you have a lot of people dying there. Some of them don't know that they died and don't move on. You have people in a very fearful state, putting out a lot of fearful or angry energy and so forth. And so through these openings in your aura, other energies can get in. In rare cases, it could include earthbound souls who just died, who don't know they died or they're not willing to let go and move on. And they come into your field and you don't know they're there because you don't know such things exist. And they start influencing you. Like, for example, let's say that earthbound soul did not want to pass on because they were addicted to something and they don't want to let go of the addiction. And oddly, you get home from the hospital and you start having an interest in this substance that you were never interested in before. So maybe you start drinking a lot more because the person was an alcoholic. And you don't understand it. And people say, oh, well, they really changed since they came home from the hospital. This is a rare and an extreme example, but it does happen. So let's say you have this information now. I explained to you, oh, well, your aura didn't heal properly after your surgery. Let's heal that up, which is an easy thing to do if you know that it's a thing that you can do. And okay, you've got some, you've got this earthbound soul in here who's trying to get you to drink so he can experience alcohol. We're going to send him to the light. Again, not a hard thing to do if you know that you can do that. And then suddenly you feel better. You know, energies are very complex. You hear people getting a heart transplant and suddenly they want to eat cornflakes all the time. And it turns out that the person whose heart you received always had cornflakes in the morning, whatever. So you can say, oh, okay, well, thank you very much for the heart. I really appreciate it. And cornflakes don't agree with me, so we're just going to send that energy out to be recycled. But there are also floating around in the air the equivalent of energetic insects who feed off of negative energies in much the same way that there are insects that feed off of rotting carcasses. So there are entities that grow big and fat through people's anger or fear. And so if you've let these entities into your energy field and they're feeding off your anger, they're going to encourage you to get even more angry. And you don't realize that this is happening. And so you become angrier and angrier and angrier. But if I come along and say, oh, you've got some entities that are feeding off of your anger, let's get rid of them. Let's just send them back to where they belong. And we do that, we seal up your energy field, and then you feel better, and you don't, suddenly this hair trigger temper is gone, and you feel peaceful again. We are all so connected to each other and to our environment far more than we know. We think of ourselves as these separate individuals, but we are connected into the mass consciousness, we're connected into the energy fields, especially of our loved ones. And so if we get a little more sophisticated about how we run our energy, we can be a lot happier and healthier. I wrote another short book about that. It's called Energy Literacy, and all these books are on my website.
You've reminded me of something else in the book. You say, a person who plays upon the largest stage of human drama represents all the people who feed into him, and those that give him his power are tied to him energetically. So is this something where it's the human that's tied to them or the soul? And can this be carried over lifetimes?
Yeah, you can't so neatly separate the human personality from the soul. You know, there we're all, you know, we're one thing. We're our whole self, which includes the soul. And stuff that gets lodged deeply into the personality rather than just something that's more superficial tends to be carried forward from lifetime to lifetime. So let's say in this lifetime, I have a defective body and a mental illness that results from that. And I behave according to that mental illness, but it doesn't go in very deep. It's really just, in my case, a physical malfunction that's causing some mental malfunctions. Well, that gave me some interesting growth experiences, but maybe it didn't lodge very deeply into me on a soul level, and maybe then therefore it won't manifest in a future lifetime. But if this condition goes more deeply into the self and speaks to issues that I have not resolved in many lifetimes, then I will carry it from lifetime to lifetime. But speaking of a world leader, like let's say a Donald Trump again, who has many followers, they are vibrationally connected to him. So all of the feeling of being a victim, of being aggrieved, of resenting, of hating immigrants and so forth, because Trump has fomented that in his followers. He has married them, in a sense, energetically. He has bonded with them. Now, the good thing is that if Trump then has a realization and wakes up in some way, preferably in this lifetime, but if it happens in any lifetime, all the people who connected to him energetically based on these negative things can have a greater opportunity to rise up and heal them, to see, you know, all of those negative, martyred sort of points of view that I nurtured for so long and that Trump supported me in holding on to. If Trump has an awakening about that, then all those people are being shown a different energy because they're connected to him. And he goes, oh my God, you know, it's like, I don't need to do this anymore, and neither do you. He could raise up a lot of those people who are connected to him energetically. It's rare. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but it could happen. And so that saying, it's all good, comes into play here, that any negative experience that any of us have had in any lifetime, if we awaken from it, if we raise it to a higher vibration, it can be used for the benefit of ourselves and others.
You did a Michael chart for me before, and I was having a look at it today, and this is something you can do for people. And I think it's a really good thing, and I think people should contact you and get their Michael chart done. But could you give us an overview of what it is?
Yes, and on my website, which is simply my name, shepherdhoodwin.com, shepherdhoodwin, there is a sample of this chart. And Simon, maybe you would like to consider uploading your chart onto your site so that people can see a sample of it there also. This is a chart of the Michael teachings. Michael explains how we as souls set up our lifetimes. The top half of your chart is your soul, and these are things that will be true of you in all of your human lifetimes on Earth. So in Simon's case, in all of your human lifetimes, you will always be a sage soul, just as I am. We're both sages. And sages are souls who focus on communication. So the top half of your chart, all of these traits are true in all of your human lifetimes. The bottom half of the chart, your overleaves, are personality traits that characterize you in this combination in your lifetime as Simon, but could be different in another lifetime. And so your Michael chart explains how you wanted to experience planet Earth and how you wanted to experience your lifetime as Simon. So in addition to being a sage soul, a communicator soul, You have a goal in this lifetime of dominance, meaning you're learning leadership in this lifetime. Your attitude is skeptic, meaning that you are a really good question asker, which we all know if we've listened to any of your podcasts. You investigate things. That's how you look at things. Your mode is caution, meaning that you navigate the physical plane carefully in this lifetime and so forth.
Great. And people can pay to have the chart done on your through your site, can't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They would just simply go to the order form and they could order it, and it guides you through how to order a Michael reading chart.
And you have several books out, don't you? It's not just the one we're talking about now and the first one we talked about.
Yes, there are 14 books of mine available on my website under the books tab. My magnum opus is my book about the Michael teachings and channeling. It's called Journey of Your Soul. A channel explores the Michael teachings.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you again. I really appreciate you coming back onto the podcast.
It's always a pleasure, Simon, anytime.
And that was an interview with Shepherd Hudwin about his book, Compassion for Evil, A Metaphysical View. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage, pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour 15 minutes. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you will have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. And also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. There is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.